The Rewind with Henry McKean. This is News Talk.
You're very welcome to The Rewind with me, Henry McKean, where we take a nostalgic look back on a year. Today, we're going back to the 1980s. The year is 1985. Over the next hour, we'll be chatting to the game changers from 1985, with movies like Back to the Future, Out of Africa, and The Goonies. The French government blew up the Greenpeace Rainbow Warrior ship over nuclear testing, and Live Aid happened, the day music changed the world. The dual benefit concert in Wembley Stadium in London and John F. Kennedy Stadium in Philadelphia, broadcast live in 150 countries to 2 billion people to raise money and awareness for the Ethiopian famine, organised by Bob Geldof and Majur. Here are people on their memories of 1985.
Obviously Live Aid, everybody kind of remembers that, but I think, you know, I grew up in South Africa in those times and maybe our focus was different. You know, we were moving towards a democracy at some point.
I wasn't living in the country in 1985, but I do remember Live Aid.
What was Ireland like in 1985?
It was good. Very good memories, yeah. It was a good time.
I watched it at home with my mum and we loved Freddie Mercury. He was the highlight of it.
So yeah, you loved that? You loved Queen?
Yeah, I loved the whole thing. Like, I liked Bob Geldof. Thought it was really, really good.
What sticks in my mind most is disco pop, trying to get the hair and the clothes right. The fashion was the main thing, wasn't it? It was like, you know, being a moth or a goth, or, you know, following the bands and, you know, having that hair that drooped over your eye, having the big shoulder pads. And then, of course, there was all those other things that was happening in the periphery, like, you know, Ethiopia and what was happening around the world, famines. At that stage, we were just kind of, I don't know if we were going into a recession or coming out of a recession, but there was certainly didn't really affect us much at that stage, because it was all about the music, it was all about the fashion for me.
The Rewind with Henry McKean.
I got to sit down with 1985 pop star Nick Kershaw. Wouldn't it be good to have a chat with him? I travelled to Navan and he told me about the riddle. We start with the sounds of Live Aid.
It's 12 noon in London, 7 a.m. in Philadelphia, and around the world, it's time for Live Aid.
Now, as a young British artist who's never had anything but hits, on Live Aid from London, would you welcome Nick Kershaw?
Good afternoon. We've got a long way to go. Come on, let's keep that energy up, yeah.
Hi, I'm Nick Kershaw.
Nick, wonderful to meet you. We're here for The Rewind. It's 1985. We're here in Navan in the Roundo pub with a gig about to take place. I want you to bring me back to that time in the 80s, to writing songs and getting that big break. You were in the cottage, and also how you advertised in Melody Maker for a manager. Then it all took off.
Yeah, I was playing in bands. Sort of early 80s and late 70s, local bands, but I was actually in a professional band playing functions, bar mitzvahs, weddings, jazz fusion, just everything under the sun. But that band split up in sort of 81, 82, and I found myself unemployed. And so I borrowed a friend's Porter studio, made some demos, sent them around to record companies, got a pile of rejection slips. And that went on for about 2 years. And a completely, absolute last throw of the dice, I put an advert in Melody Maker for management.
And then it happened.
And I got a response from this guy calling himself Mickey Modern. And he used to manage Nine Below Zero. Sent him a tape and we met up. And he got me a deal with one of the guys who turned me down from a previous meeting. But got me a deal. Made the record, and it just happened like clockwork after that.
And, you know, the hits, the riddle, I won't let the sun go down on me, and also Wouldn't It Be Good? I mean, absolutely huge hits. And then later on, when you started songwriting, Chesney Hawkes, the one and only. And here we are, 40 years later. I'm here to ask you about Live Aid. You were just in your mid-20s. And how did you meet Sir Bob Geldof, and how did it all happen?
Yeah, I wasn't involved in the Band Aid thing. That happened in the December, obviously, that was November, December 84. I think it was January 85. There was a bunch of us at Heathrow Airport about to disappear to a big sort of pop festival in Germany. And Bob was just at the airport lurking. I don't know if he was about to catch another plane somewhere.
He was lurking,
else.
A bit like the way I was lurking today.
Yeah, exactly. So he was, and he was just approaching people and press ganging them into this concert. There was going to be a concert. That's all we knew. Done the Bad Nay thing. We were just going to put on a gig. It was going to be, I don't know, Hammersmith Odeon or whatever. And, you know, Bob asks, and you don't say no to Bob.
And it's difficult to say no to him.
It is extremely difficult. So, yeah, I said yes and then forgot all about it for like 2 or 3 months until all of a sudden it started, you know, started getting on the news, and then the venue was going to be the Wembley Arena, and then it's going to be Wembley Stadium, and then there was going to be one in Philadelphia, and then there's going to be 2 billion people watching on the television. It was just crazy watching it kind of snowball like that.
What was it like? The 2 billion people performing live in Wembley in front of all those people. Did you know that you were a part of history, that you were on the stage with some of the biggest names, including yourself? You had obviously Queen up there. You had them all there. What was that like?
Yeah, that, absolutely, you were aware of that. I mean, even if you can't see the 2 billion people, you've got them in the back of your head and all those cameras. And bear in mind, I'd only been kind of on the scene for about 18 months, so I was a bit of a new boy. I was very much punching above my weight and out of my depth, so, and there were a few of us in the same position. So I just wanted to get through it, really. It was pretty intimidating and terrifying. And also, I wasn't used to playing festivals like that, and when you didn't get sound checks, you didn't get line checks.
You were just up there. You had to get up there very, very quickly and do your thing. 18 minutes only.
Absolutely. You walk on stage, you just hope that your gear's there and that some of it's working and that you can hear yourself and all this kind of stuff.
And your stuff did work. Paul McCartney had an issue with his microphone and other artists came to kind of help him. That spectacle, and you're a big David Bowie fan, getting to hang out with him backstage, what was that like?
Yeah, I didn't exactly get to hang out with David, but
he got to hang out with you.
What did happen though is when the show had finished and we all came off stage after the big finale, we all got put on minibuses to take us back to the conference centre, which is where our gear was. And I just became aware of the fact that the guy sitting behind me was David Bowie on a minibus. I had about a 2.5 minute journey to try and figure out, summon the words to say to him, you know, just to sort of say, tell him why he was the reason I didn't have a proper job and how amazing I thought he was.
That's how influential he was on you. I know that your parents, for example, got you into music. They were, you know, into a little bit of music. Your dad, the flute, and your mum, you know, a performer. But Bowie was the one that we thought, hang on a second, I could be a successful pop star.
Yeah, I don't know about it. Well, it certainly, it was like, before that, I wanted to be a racing car driver or an actor or something like that. Something, the centre of attention, basically. But, yeah, there was a light bulb moment. I remember seeing a documentary on a little 20 minute documentary on a magazine program called Nationwide on the BBC one Tuesday evening or something.
You just caught it?
Yeah, I just caught it, and it was about David Bowie, and he was touring the Lad Insane album, and although I was aware of a little bit about Bowie, I just kind of thought that was just like, right, that's what I want to do. I want to do that.
And when you think that myself and yourself and everyone, we were alive when David Bowie was alive, that will always cheer me up to know that you shared the same stage, the same air as him.
Yeah, that was special. In fact, I did nearly meet him a couple of, I bumped into him a few times and never summoned I never spoke a word to him. So in New York, I was touring with Paul Young, And we had a gig at the Pier in New York. And I did my set. It was a really completely bizarre evening. The whole thing was really strange. I remember Miles Davis coming to see me. I mean, it was just completely extraordinary. But then I was backstage, and there was Billy Joel and Christy Brinkley, and there was a bunch of people up there. And then I saw Mark Knopfler. I thought, oh, I'll go and say hello to him. Is that just trying to find an opening line? And I thought, well, what do I say to him? We're both guitarists. Let's talk about guitars, okay? And Money for Nothing had just come out, and I thought, I wonder how he got that sound. I mean, that what kind of pedal he used, and what kind of effects he used on it, and how he. That's really fascinating. So I went up to him and I said, Mark, I'm Nick Kershaw. How did you get that sound on Money for Nothing? And he looked at me and said, it was a guitar.
So he wasn't much crack.
He wasn't. He was, I don't know if he, he's probably very nice. I know people that know him very well, and he's a very nice man, I'm sure he is. But I just caught him at the wrong moment, I think.
And that's the thing. I mean, we forget that. You were also young, all these pop stars in the 80s. And with Live Aid, how did everyone keep their egos in check?
Well, there were a whole bunch of us just kind of like little frightened mice, couldn't believe that we were there. That was a bunch of us. And the rest of them, I think if they'd left their egos at home, no one would have had a show, would they? So it was, okay, you know, everybody, I think we all kind of knew what we were there for. And I think that really hit home when David Bowie came off a song early and they played. It wasn't actually Michael Burke's film. I thought it was. My memory said it was, but then I saw a documentary the other day, and it was a film that CBS filmed, but of the scenes of famine and with the Cars music behind it. And Who's Going to Drive You Home?
And what a tune! What a track! For you, being involved in something like that saved countless lives, perhaps millions of lives, and the hundreds and hundreds of millions, and then the billions in debt in Live Aid 20 years later, yeah, being written off. What do you think the legacy is of Live Aid and your involvement in, I suppose, saving all those lives in that famine?
It's a very difficult question for someone like me to answer, because basically someone asked me to do a gig and I did a gig. I just turned up with my band and we played some songs. But, you know, Bob obviously is the man to ask that question. There's a whole lot of conversation about, you know, the Great White Saviour thing and all that, but nobody was doing anything at the time, and Bob did. Someone stood up and did something. And I think that's an important thing. That, you know, I think we've kind of all got compassion fatigue over the years. But it's the very simple legacy is there's a whole load of people out there alive now that wouldn't be alive otherwise. You know.
And Nick Kershaw, your favourite 80s memory?
Oh blimey, that's a tricky one. There were just loads of them. It's all a bit cloudy. You'll understand, because it was a long time ago. But there were loads of fabulous gigs, loads of fabulous moments in studios, you know, eureka moments and great things happening. And I met some lovely people and had a good old laugh, I think. But that, just mash it all up into one. I can't remember one event, you know. People think, you expect me to say, well, it was Live Aid, but that was kind of, that's quite stressful.
And it was stressful for you. You were up there in front of all those people having to remember the words of your own song hard.
Yeah, and not entirely succeeding, but there you go.
Well, Nick Kershaw, this is The Rewind. It's 1985. A pleasure to meet you.
Well, thanks very much.
I got it back.
The Rewind with Henry McKean.
Please, please, give us as much money as we know you have.
I'm here on Concord and we're 30 away across the Atlantic. Phil Collins, I'm just Phil back.
We got to chat to Sir Bob Geldof on the exact day of the 40th anniversary of Live Aid, and that was the 13th of July. Here is Bob, back in 85.
Mick and David did that video specifically so that you could give something, and it's not happening enough. You know, you've got to get on the phone and take the money out of your pocket. Don't go to the pub tonight, please. stay in and give us the money. There are people dying now, so give me the money. And here's the numbers.
Let's
read
go
them
through
out.
The way. I think we're probably going to get the address just, first, aren't we?
No, let's the address. Let's get the numbers, because that's how we're going to get it.
So thank you so much for joining us, Sir Bob. This is The Rewind. It's 1985, and this is the 40th anniversary today of Live Aid. And Bob, bring us back to that time, and can you believe we're still talking about that legacy 40 years on?
Well, it's not so much talking about it. I mean, I deal with it every day. I mean, I woke up this morning. I was in Manchester just having been to the Oasis gig, so I was still buzzing from that. And you know, as usual, my emails are full of Band-Aid stuff. And so, you know, for me, it's a daily thing. But as I went down to the reception, all the people working in reception and the people in reception said, "Happy Live Aid Day, Bob." They don't have their own Paddy's Day here, so they've decided it could be Live Aid Day, you know. It's very odd for me. I'm rushing now because I have to go to a gala performance of the Live Aid musical just for one day. And obviously there's a guy playing me. He's a 6'3" scouser. And when I first saw him doing me, he was mortifying. I expected the accent is very hard because it's South Dublin. It doesn't modulate you. And I thought he'd come on and be doing, "Sure, I Bob geared up." And actually he had it down. And I spoke to him. I said, it did sound like me really. And he said, but when I was 9 years old, my party piece was my granny used to make me get up on the kitchen table in Liverpool and do impersonations of Bob Geldof. So destiny called. And then there's these different sort of parties which seem kind of inappropriate but celebratory. It's resonated in memory simply because it worked. It was the beginning of a 20-year haul up until 20 years ago exactly, when the boys and girls with guitars and pianos corralled the political and economic structures of the world at Live 8 and forced them to alter the circumstances, certainly the dialogue between the North and the South. At least that's what Kofi Annan said. It was the Rubicon crossing moment, you know, and it started with the small Christmas song that was only ever meant to make a few bob. But that's been my life. So it's very hard to go back to a specific day where I have obviously specific memories, which I've retold, rehashed endless times. It's at the same time, it's wonderful and it can be used. I mean, one of the reviews of the 3 1-hour documentaries, which are going out live now on CNN, they played the entire concert. One of the reviews said the greatest achievement of Live Aid was that 40 years on, they've managed to make African poverty still sexy again. It's an inappropriate expression, but I wouldn't have dreamt it possible. But I'm very glad in this death of kindness that we seem to be going through via Trump, Barnes and Musk, that there's something waving a small flag still fluttering for the poor.
If you go 40 years back, it was the Second World War, the end of the Second World War. Here we are now, 40 years on from 85. Do you think the kids will be talking about this in another 40 years?
No, I don't think so. I think individual performances will resonate down the years when they talk about the rock period, the rock and roll period. I think that's over now. I think it, not because of Live Aid, but it was probably a 50-year pop for convenience sake, 1955 to 2005. 2004 is when Google made a profit for the first time. Facebook was invented. So social media took over where pop had been. And rock and roll in my time was the spine of the culture. It sort of didn't dictate, but it determined so many ideas, political, theological, philosophical, economic, social, not the least being fashion or media. And that's not the case anymore. There's still brilliant artists, still brilliant songs, but it's more like the music of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, where music was important to you personally. You'll always remember that song when you kiss the girl or the boy or whatever. That'll always be there. But as a motivator of a determinant of society and a pointer of direction, I don't think that's the case anymore. So it'll be looked upon as a curiosity, but the performances, given that they were the greatest artists of the rock age, and they were doing it all for nothing.
All right.
I think some of the performances, U2's performance, which is what broke them worldwide, people suddenly saw how great this band was. Queen obviously is famous.
And you're right. I mean, that huge legacy.
I gotta go, Henry.
Well, look, Sir Bob, happy Live Aid Day, and thank you so much for chatting to us.
Thanks a lot, mate. Bye bye.
I think you know the next song. It might be a bit of a cock up, but if you're gonna cock it up, you may as well do it with 2 billion people watching you. So let's cock it up together.
And you're very welcome back. This is The Rewind. It's 1985, and I'm here with Jonathan DeBurka Butler. Jonathan, welcome to the programme, and we're going back 40 years. It was some year, wasn't it?
It really was, Henry. There was a lot of mad stuff going on. I was only 9 at the time, but there's some things that I remember.
Yes.
Really very clearly. One of those was the whole moving statues phenomenon. I know this was 5 years before you got here, wasn't it?
I got here in 1990, yeah. And I think I was 6 going on 7 in 85.
Yes. Yeah. So this was peak Catholicism in Ireland at the time. And it all started in County Kerry, of all places. So it started in a little village called Asdee, where some school children saw 2 moving statues in a church there. But then the phenomenon spread throughout the country. And by the end of the whole thing, there was 30 sites, no fewer than 30 sites across the country.
Amazing.
Where statues were allegedly supposed to have moved. The most famous place was probably in Ballinspittle in Cork. It's estimated that about 100,000 people, if not more than 100,000 people, actually came to visit a site there, a grotto where a beautiful white statue of the Virgin Mary was said to have moved on several occasions.
And where was she going?
Well, she wasn't really going anywhere. She was just doing a little jig or a little dance or maybe even just
moving
a little
slightly
movement of her shoulder.
Wow.
And of course, people interpreted this as being a sign that, she had chosen to speak to the people who had come along to visit. But not everybody was convinced. There was a number of people who came along to look at the statues, and of course they didn't see anything moving. And even the Catholic Church itself wasn't particularly convinced. There was one famous quote from a bishop where he said, "It wasn't the job of the Virgin Mary to move herself, but to move others." I just remember that even at 9 years of age, I can still remember the reports. There was wall-to-wall reports on these moving statues. It was quite the phenomenon.
Absolutely fascinating. And we're going to talk about Knock Airport. A big year for Knock.
Yeah, it was another miracle that happened up in Mayo. This time it was driven by Monsignor James Horan, who is quite a charismatic figure in the area. And he opened Knock Airport. And the first flight was a pilgrimage to Rome. Now, it's been open, as you say, 40 years is how far we're looking back. I think I've only ever met one person who's actually flown into it. My brother-in-law flew into it when we were visiting down in Mayo. Have you ever flown
into it? I visited a lot, to be honest with you, but normally I've driven to it.
Yeah.
And I did have a plane that couldn't land at Dublin Airport that I was on because of high winds.
Okay.
So we landed there, and then we had to take a coach back that took 3 hours.
Wow.
And it's a lovely airport, really. I think it's called Ireland West as well. Beautiful airport. And I think we should all take it. If you live in the West, definitely support Knock. Also, we're staying with aviation, but this is a much sadder story.
Yeah, this was this was a tragic story that happened off the coast of Ireland. This was Air India Flight 182, which plunged into the Atlantic. The last air tower that it was in touch with was Shannon. There are descriptions of the people there who were looking at the maps of the planes flying around the world and in their area, and all of a sudden this plane just dropped out of the sky and dropped off the radar. All 323 people on board died, unfortunately. Now, they were flying from Canada to Delhi in India, and it was later discovered that it was actually as a result of a bomb that was put on board by Sikh terrorists. A very sad story indeed, and an awful lot of the relations had to then fly into Ireland and, of course, be comforted and identify the bodies here and take the relations back home.
Horrific. We're going to move on to sport. A huge Irish sporting year, 85.
Spillane gathers beautifully. In go the Irish forwards. This is Lenehan bursting into the 22. Back to Bradley. Back to Kiernan. The drop of goal is over. Michael Kiernan has done it.
It was a great year for sport in 1985. Mm. And I'm very surprised at how many of these I actually remember.
Yes.
The first one was Ireland winning the Triple Crown. Now, younger listeners will kind of say to this, well, we win the Triple Crown all the time.
It's
but
no
back
biggie.
Then, yeah, no biggie. But back then, we didn't win many at all. And the fact that we beat England in the last game was really the icing on the cake. It was a huge game. I remember Brendan Mullen opened the scoring with a block down try. And then in the last few moments, Michael Kiernan, who was playing in the centre at the time, he scored a drop goal and he brought the score to 13-10. So they only won by 3 points. Now, I was at home watching with a friend of mine.
You watched it live.
I watched it live at home with Bobby Perkins while my brothers were brought in to actually watch the game with my father.
Wow.
So this is something that I still feel the pain about, obviously.
A huge year for snooker.
Yeah, huge year for snooker. I think this was the standout sporting memory for me. This was Dennis Taylor winning the World Snooker Championship. Anybody who saw it won't forget it. He won it on the last black in the last frame. He had been 7-0 down at one stage. So the first session ended 7-0. He was playing against the world number one, known as the grinder, Steve Davis, who had won, I think, 3 of the last 4 world championships at the time. So nobody really gave Dennis Taylor a chance at all. And the crowds, the number of people that watched it on TV, 18.5 million people in the UK watched him
match
that famous black in 1985 to win the World Championship.
Unbelievable. And back then, everyone was smoking as well.
Everybody was smoking.
I always remember that.
You had characters like Jimmy White and Alex Higgins and Kirk Stevens and all of these great characters. It's changed a lot, snooker, in this day and age.
By your unanimous decision, Barry McGuigan is
champion of the world. They've all voted for him, and all 25,000 people in the stadium had already voted for him. At 24, the Clonus Cyclone has swept one of the world's great champions out of the way.
Barry McGuigan, I mean, a massive year for him, and the fact that he brought, you could say, communities together in the border counties. He really did. I mean, people said, leave the fighting to Barry McGuigan.
Indeed, yeah. The wee man from Monaghan, he won his world title against Eusebio Pedroza in Loftus Road in London, I think it is, isn't it? Loftus Road football stadium there. And it really made an impression on people. This was in the summer that this happened, but about 6 months later, he actually was named BBC Sports Personality of the Year, which was quite a thing to get back in those days. And it did have quite an effect on the country. Again, he was quite a charismatic figure, a great talker. And, you know, people were really drawn to him because of his character, you know, he was a lovely
man. I remember Barry.
And he is a lovely man.
And I was at 6 at the time. And we're going to stick with sport, but now we're going to talk a little bit about some dreadful tragedies when it came to sport.
Yeah, there was 2 really dreadful tragedies that happened. And one that really made global headlines was in Heysel in Brussels. This was the final of the European Cup, known as the Champions League now, when Liverpool were playing Juventus. There were 3 Irish internationals playing on the Liverpool team at the time, Jim Beglin, Ronnie Whelan and Mark Lawrenson. But before the game actually began, there was a group of hooligans, Liverpool hooligans, who really ran at Juventus fans, and they caused a crush to happen, and over 30 people were killed in the stadium. The scenes were just unbelievable, and even looking back on them now, they sort of send shivers down the spine. The match inexplicably was played. They went ahead with the game. Juventus won it 1-0. But even the Juventus team had actually explicitly requested that the game be stopped. But authorities at the time thought, well, you know, it might cause more
to control
trouble.
The crowds
yeah,
and keep the game going.
Cause more trouble if we don't let the match go ahead. And it did go ahead. But the fallout from it was huge. All English clubs were banned from European competitions for 5 years, a few months after that. And it really had a massive effect on English football for a long time.
And also, this is something that's been in the news recently because of the 40th anniversary, a fire at Bradford Football Club.
Yeah, it really was a shocking year for football in the UK. There was a fire at Bradford Football Club which killed 56 people. Now, I don't know, have you seen the recent documentary that's been made?
I haven't watched it. I've seen clips.
It's unbelievable. It's a wonderful documentary, if I can, for want of a better way of putting it. It is a wonderful documentary. But, you know, there had been previous warnings about this particular stand and the fact that it was in terrible conditions and that there'd been a huge build-up of litter speaker in the cavity below the stand. Now, it was actually due to be taken down and a new demolished and a new steel structure was going to be put in place. But unfortunately, the fire came before that happened and those 56 people were killed and many more injured. I would highly recommend having a look at that documentary if you get the chance.
Well, Jonathan de Burka Butler, The Rewind 1985, thank you for bringing us back to 40 years ago.
The Rewind with Henry McKean.
And we're going to be joined now by Grace O'Sullivan, activist and former MEP. I want you, Grace, and you're very welcome, by the way, to bring us back to 1985 and your time as an activist with the Rainbow Warrior.
Henry, I was a 23-year-old Irish girl from Waterford, grew up in Tramore, and I had joined Greenpeace previously when I was just turning 21. And in 1984, I joined the flagship of the Greenpeace International Environmental Organization. The name of the ship was Rainbow Warrior. We had converted it from a motor vessel to a sailing vessel because already back in 1985, we were concerned about burning fossil fuel and the impact on the climate. It was all, at that time, we were on the anti-nuclear campaign. So we were trying to get the Pacific Island nations to protest in the United Nations against the countries like France, like the US, like the UK that were testing nuclear bombs. And our objective was to sail to New Zealand to resupply our ship then, because we were at sea for several months, and then to sail on to French Polynesia, the area near to Tahiti, to a place called Mururoa, where the French government were testing underground nuclear bombs. And we were arguing that, you know, these weapons were weapons of mass destruction, caused a huge annihilation of people and nature. And that was our objective. So we sailed into Auckland, New Zealand, just a few days before the 10th of July, 1985.
Like then and now, you're out talking to us in nature and you care so much about nature. The fact that the French government, agents of the French government, actually blew the ship up, and thankfully you weren't on it at the time. Tell us what happened and the aftermath of that, Grace.
Yeah, well, first, just to remind everyone, you know, the French government under the command of François Mitterrand, the president, gave the order to the French Secret Service to place two bombs, two limpet mines on our ship, the Rainbow Warrior. We were in harbour and the first bomb went off at midnight and the captain saw the water obviously coming into the ship and gave the order to abandon ship. And then they didn't know, I mean, that we were a target of a terrorist attack at the time. The crew were on the quayside. And then our great friend, Fernando Pereira, he was the photographer on board. He went back down to his cabin because, you know, the last thing he expected was another explosion. And he wanted to retrieve his cameras. And when he went back on board, the second bomb went off. And the water just came into to the cabin where he was. And he drowned, he died, he was murdered that night. And that had obviously an awful impact on us crew members who had been sailing with Fernando for months on end. So it took some time before it was clear that it was a terrorist attack. The New Zealand government were absolutely extraordinary in their investigation. They left no stone unturned. And they found within a few short months that there was a huge strategy conducted by the French to try to disarm the Rainbow Warrior so that we wouldn't go to French Polynesia, to Mururoa, to try to stop their nuclear testing. So look, it was, you know, thinking back, it was a terrible thing to do. In hindsight, as a result of that, and as a result of us, a few of us sailed out on a small yacht a few weeks later, and we stopped the testing, the nuclear testing, at the programme at the time, and we interfered with it out at Mururoa at French Polynesia. And within a few short years, the French government stopped their underground nuclear testing programme. You know, it was a success, the campaign, but the losing a friend and a colleague and a father of his children and husband was just a terrible price to pay. So, you know, at the time, I remember my own mother and father saying, look, really, it's too dangerous. You need to come back home to Tremore. But at the time, you know, I was deeply committed to the work of Greenpeace and to environmental conservation, which I've continued to do. You know, every year and very often I think of Fernando and you know, what happened at that time. It did have a brutal impact on all of our lives, all the crew members on board. And we were just a small crew of 13 people.
Well, Grace, I just wanted to say thank you so much for joining us and reminding us of your time on the Rainbow Warrior. This is The Rewind 1985. Thank you.
Thank you, Henry.
Up next, the pop culture of 1985.
David O'Callaghan from the Here and Back Again podcast.
Welcome back to another Rewind. It's 1985.
I know.
I mean, what a year. I mean, what a brilliant, brilliant year in every way. For you, what are your fondest memories when it comes to pop culture in 85?
Oh my God, 85, what a time to be alive that was. Some of the most iconic movies that still to this day resonate with people worldwide. And some have stood the test of time and are kind of ones that families have handed down to their younger kids. And if the younger kids don't like them, they're like, you're not my kid. This type of stuff. So that year we're talking The Breakfast Club, yes. Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome, Legend, if people remember, Tom Goodale, Tom Cruise, Cocoon, St. Elmo's Fire. And then on the award-worthy side, yes, you had Out of Africa, The Colour Purple, Kiss of the Spider Woman and Witness were also released. However, I got to focus on the ones that I still to this day watch. And
you still watch these ones
and I still have VHSs. And DVDs of these. Well,
you still have a VHS machine that works?
Yes, believe it or not.
Wow.
The Goonies.
The Goonies. The Goonies. Is iconic. Try to get my 7-year-old to watch it. I can't get him to watch it.
Yeah, well, then you know, you need to
have
words.
But I will.
Yeah, you need to have words with that child. A group of young misfits discovering an ancient map, and then it just becomes this pirate treasure. It's Richard Donner's, it's an iconic family movie. It just has a place in the heart of so many people. Like, I adore it. I have a poster in my house that is on the wall. It's kind of a rite of passage movie. It is wonderful. It is insanely wonderful. And I just go back every few years. I kind of go, do you know what? The Goonies. And it is that classic 80s thing where it's slightly older than, like, family movies today are safe as houses. And there's not, the 80s family movies are like, it's a bit scary there. And, you know, hey, you guys, who, you know, Chunk and you know, all that. It was amazing.
Sloth, you're going to live with me now.
Huh?
I'm going to take care of you. Because I love you.
I love you, Chunk.
Oh, I love you, Sloth.
Iconic. Chunk was
also
iconic.
In 1985 was an amazing moment for two actors who kind of were at the, this is probably the peak of their powers.
Yes.
So you had a young lad with great comedic timing called Michael J. Fox. So he released both Back to the Future and Teen Wolf in this year.
Wait a minute, Doc. Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
Hello? Anybody home? Hey! Think with fly thing.
Calvin, why do you keep calling me Calvin?
Well, that is your name, isn't it? Calvin Klein?
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
You know, when we take Back to the Future, one of my favorite movies of all time. Just unbelievable. An unreal film. And then I saw Back to the Future, not in 85, but in 1986 in Scotland, because there was always a delay.
Oh, there's always a lag.
There was a lag, a good 6 months or longer. And oh my, I fell in love with it. I still love it. But this is terrible to admit, I only saw Teen Wolf quite recently.
Yes.
And it didn't do as well. Which one came out first? I can't even remember.
Back to the Future, no, Teen Wolf came first and then Back to the Future. But it was the rise of, I think, funny enough, if it was the other way around, Teen Wolf probably would have done much better. Based on the fact that obviously Back to the Future was a massive success, but then he went on to bigger and you know obviously two more movies in the series, and then also weirdly in the same year, Sylvester. So that was the kind of the young upstart, and then you had the Arnie versus Sly Stallone battle was happening at the time for the hero. So Arnie released Commando in 85, but absolutely terrible movie, but it was what it
terrible
was.
But good.
Terrible but good. However, Sylvester Stallone released two movies that year, one of which was Rambo First Blood Part 2, which was a worldwide sensation. By the way, Back to the Future was the biggest movie of the year in the box office.
Not surprised.
But Rambo First Blood Part 2 and Rocky 4, which most people forget about, but Rocky 4 existed, both in the same year. It's kind of mad when you think, like, what?
Two massive franchises by the same actor in the same year.
There's this weird thing where, like, I would have been 85, I was 14, and I loved First Blood. I'd seen First Blood on VHS, and I wanted to see, because this had become, it was the one where he was like, Hot Shots Part 2 and all used to take the mick out of him with his kind
That's right. It also did very, very well a few
years
later.
But it was 18s in Ireland. So the Green Cinema in St. Stephen's Green, they were showing Brewster's Millions in Screen 1.
Great movie.
Or Screen 2. We'll get to that. And so I paid 3 times to go see Brewster's Millions with the idea that once the trailer's finished, me and my mates would sneak into First Blood.
You could sneak in.
We got caught 3 times.
And that was before CCTV. Yeah, they were onto you.
They were just.
You'd have a better chance of doing it now.
Half the cinema was full of kids trying to get into. I would like to say that on our fourth opportunity, the guy actually said, "Well, you're giving us good business. Just don't tell anybody." And he let us in. Like,
brilliant.
And it was amazing. But because of that, Brewster's Millions is this amazing movie. For me, a lot of people weirdly don't know it. Yeah. It's Richard Pryor.
Highly entertaining.
He gets given £1 million. He's not allowed to tell anybody that, but if he can spend £1 million in 30 days, every penny of it, he gets all this fortune.
He gets more.
But he can't. So everybody thinks he's losing his mind and they're trying to help him. He's like, and he's going insane because he's just trying to spend it all. And people are like, oh no, I've put your money away here. It is, if you have not seen Brewster's Millions,
it's fantastic. It is a fantastic
absolutely love it.
Movie.
And then, so the highest grosses movies of the year were Back to the Future, then Rambo, Beverly Hills Cop, even though it was December 84,
Ireland, 85. It was 85.
Rocky IV, and then Cocoon. And then the Oscars that year, Amadeus won in 85, but that was for 84. But the movies released in 85, Out of Africa was the big winner that won 7 Oscars in the year.
And my mum loves that movie. Yes. She still goes on about Out of Africa.
That movie, a snooze fest. Give me Rambo any day.
Oh, stinks in here, doesn't it? Ain't working.
Rich!
Well, he ain't gonna answer now if he didn't answer before, is he? Oh, careful, Arthur.
Rage.
He's dead.
Dead drunk.
No, he's dead.
No, he's not. I can still feel his pulse.
EastEnders and Neighbours both landed that year.
Like, both
like,
of them.
Our heads exploded because, and talk about two opposites. Like one was the bleakest of bleak and still is the bleakest of bleak.
So
and I'm not talking about Neighbours here. Yeah. And then you had Ramsey Street versus Albert Square. You had the Robinson family versus the Ramsey family. Watts' Mitchells. It was just fantastic stuff, and I remember like being absolutely hooked on this, and like I was a 14-year-old lad who like could not stop watching, like lunchtime Neighbours, like was just,
I loved the way they used to have it on at lunchtime.
Yeah, it was,
and it was the one the night before that it was like a repeat,
and then
of that,
the,
and then
the half six
it.
One would be the kind of, and it was absolutely brilliant. And then also released, so obviously they never went away. Neighbours briefly went away and then came back again, but so it's kind of mad to think that they both landed. But also, people may remember there was a small little show about four, shall we say, elderly women living in a flat share almost in Miami, Blanche, Rose, Dorothy and Sophia. And it was the Golden Girls was launched and it took the world by storm.
And people love that.
And to this day, people go on about.
And they still, you still see it
Betty
on TikTok.
White, Betty White. Bless her contacts. And then also that year, a certain future movie star got his TV debut. Bruce Willis and Sybil Shepherd started in the romantic comedy private detective drama Moonlight.
Do you know I would like to watch that right now? Is anyone showing it? I would love to sit down now and watch Moonlighting.
I might.
It was great.
Oh, you know, I have VHS. I don't have the DVD.
You know, it was a pure escapism. There was lots of flirtation. There was lots of chemistry.
Will they, won't they? That classic, you know, for, yeah, it's...
And it was well written, yeah. And it was an enjoyable watch.
The quips, you could see... You could tell how big Bruce was going to be because he was just all charm and smarm. And yeah, he was very funny.
And then other
TV series of note released were MacGyver, sure, who didn't love that? The Equalizer, Dempsey and Make Peace, and Max Headroom Show. But one I want to give a shout out to, and it's probably one that maybe two people will know what I'm talking about.
Go on.
But it was a show called Street Hawk.
Didn't watch Street Hawk. Remember it, but I never
Street
got
Hawk
to watch it.
Is the poor man's Knight Rider. So Knight Rider had Kit.
I loved Knight Rider.
Airwolf had the helicopter. Mm-hmm. Basically, Street Hawk was a motorbike that just looked like a motorbike that was painted black and had kind of bombs to shoot it, but they didn't look like the Kit.
So it was a poor man's.
It was terrible. And when I was looking at it, I was like, oh my God, it only lasted one season, yet it's drilled into my head up there with Airwolf. And
why? Did you like it so much?
I have no idea. And yes, it's true. I do have the box set because it's only one season, but it is. I don't know why. It's absolutely terrible, but I loved it. So that, you know, TV and movies, 85, as I said, what a time to be alive.
Well, Dave O'Callaghan, thank you so much for dropping in for 1985 for The Rewind. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for The Rewind 1985. Thanks to Aoife Breen, Aidan McKelvey and Simon Tierney, as well as Mark Simpson. Until the next time, I'm Henry McKean, and thanks for joining us.